Hello and welcome to the BSG podcast. I am your illustrious host, Chase, and with me today is my not as illustrious co-host, Quinn. How are you doing today?
I'm voluptuous. That's what I'm. I'm voluptuous, you're illustrious, whatever. I'm doing good, but if you don't know what the BSG podcast is, we are an informative bi-weekly podcast focused on gaming news and discussions. On Mondays, we go over the news for the week, covering everything gaming without the BS. And on Wednesdays, we pick a juicy topic to cover, and this one is juicy, and we give our half-informed opinions. But this time, I feel like we have very informed opinions about what we're talking about, so stay tuned.
So today we're going to be going over loot boxes part one. We're going to have a multiple part episodes. And so basically this one is going to be the history of loot boxes. And so we're in this episode, we're going to be going over the pre-loot box era all the way up to the big controversy known as Battlefront 2. For part two and three, we're going to be having the criticisms and all the issues that had happened and all the legislation that occurred. And then for part three, we'll eventually talk about its future and what are some potential, maybe even fixes or even our opinions, because that might be the BS point where we'll jump in.
And if you want to talk to us, if you want to chat, you want to talk about loot boxes and how we don't know anything about loot boxes, you can do so on Twitter at BS Gamers Podcast. We've been waiting. We're patiently waiting for someone to reach out and talk to us.
Quinn has been so lonely.
Right. I've been having to deal with Chase. I want other people to deal with. Come on, give me a break.
Yeah, you know, it's starting to get to a weekly point where he has to yell at me at least once a week off the air.
Yeah, and multiple times. Not even once. Just like at least three times I got to get pissed off at Chase. That's what's happening at this point. But if you want Chase to be taken care of, there's one thing you could really do, and that would be leaving a review on the podcast. If I see a review, one review equals one being nice to Chase, okay?
I would appreciate it,
guys.
Get
those reviews in, and Chase will be taken care of. If not, he's getting the beaten.
All right, let's jump right on in then. So I wanted to first talk about the pre-loot box era. And, you know, there's a lot of jumping points to start off with this. We can talk about when games were first bought, you just paid a certain amount of money. We eventually turned to things like DLC. And what is the reason why we did all this? It was because games at some point, essentially, we talked about this in a previous podcast, that games were forced at a certain price, which was like $50 or $60, and they weren't going any higher because people were essentially refusing to buy games at a higher price. And so with this happening, essentially companies had to think of other ways to, I guess, monetize their games. And so we had many experimental times during the pre-loot box era. We had games like Neopets, which had microtransactions. We had RuneScape, which had a membership fee. We had WoW, which had subscriptions. And so we were seeing a lot of different payment methods, especially on PCs.
I think it's an important thing to clarify that during this time, consoles were pretty set in their ways and they didn't have microtransactions. Most games didn't have microtransactions. It's pretty much you're paying $60 and then maybe getting DLC at a later point. Mm-hmm. But there were no additional microtransactions happening. And on the PC, things were a lot different, especially just like web-based games that I guess aren't exclusive to PCs. But web-based games, which were basically free, and they needed to figure out how they could make money to actually host their website and actually continue to pay for development. You saw things like Neopets or free Flash-based games that had ways where you could purchase additional points or coins or some in-game currency that allowed you to either play more games or purchase some things. And so that's where like these little microtransactions started happening. And like Chase mentioned, some games like RuneScape found that their way to work, their workaround, I guess, was to have a membership fee. And WoW did a similar thing, except it was you had to subscribe to WoW.
And we noticed in both of them, at least, WoW, for example, had like a small progression period where you can play it for free up to, I believe it was level 5 when it first came out. And then you would have to pay for the subscription fee in order to continue playing. So you would start to see games where you can play it for free for at least some parts, maybe even all of it, like RuneScape. But if you paid a membership fee, you can go much further, much deeper into the game, which was actually a lot of ways that you could say Flash-based games and other games were doing it for memberships. But also, yes,
there was a microtransaction. Is that accurate, though?
Yes.
I don't think WoW actually had a free version.
It did. It had up to level 5. I played
it. When it launched?
Yep. I played it.
Huh.
When I first played WoW,
I played up to level 5. Free until level 20.
I played it up to level 5 when I was playing at our cousin's house. They had it where you can play up to level 5 and then you have to pay for a subscription after that.
Wow, that must have sucked. You can't really do anything up to level 5.
Well, yeah, the whole point was like this was a brand new game and it was it had a lot right. of cool details and stuff like that, and so it kind of got you interested the moment with paying or not paying with getting up to that point.
With getting to the point where you would pay, yeah.
Yeah, and then because it wasn't that much content, you would be like, "Oh, I want to play more."
Right.
Yeah, cuz I know I did it within the day for sure to get to level 5.
And I think in a weird way, and although this is sort of a tangent, I feel like you could tell or you knew who was upper middle class and who was lower middle class, I guess, by if they were playing RuneScape or WoW, because WoW was subscription based. Mm-hmm. And like you said, RuneScape actually allowed you to pretty much play the entire game without a membership.
Yeah. The only problem was is that there were so many items being all locked. Essentially.
Right.
And so you couldn't play it. It's up to a certain
point. It was more difficult, yeah. Another thing we wanted to talk about was how potentially the idea of loot boxes began. And we wanted to talk about a version of games that isn't digital or isn't actually a video game, but collectible card games. And these could be potentially what was the precursor to loot boxes to begin with, because what you would do is you would open a card pack and not know what was inside. And in a weird way, it is kind of like gambling, because actual physical cards do have a real world value and have varying degrees of rarity, which give them more or less value. So that's kind of interesting.
A set of first generation Pokemon cards just sold for $100,000. So, I mean, they have value.
Yeah, which is kind of interesting.
It is crazy, because I actually have some of the old cards as well. So I'm like, maybe if I wait 30 more years,
oh my God,
I'll be a millionaire.
That's Chase's work plan.
Yeah, it's my work plan.
I'll survive for 30 years, and then I can go buy a car with my Pokemon card. Jesus.
So, to give you an idea what a loot box, if you don't quite understand what a loot box is from collectible card games, what it basically is it's a consumable virtual item received through some form of random selection. It can range from cosmetic items to customize your avatar or game-changing weapons and armor. Generally, it must be monetizable. So that's the, I guess, the important aspect of it there, because we will get into... Would you argue that like Overwatch can probably say that it's not necessarily loot boxes since it's not monetizable?
It is monetizable. You can purchase loot boxes. That is
monetization. Okay. You can't sell it though. I guess that's a different thing then.
That's a different thing. But yeah, like if a game offers, there is no way to purchase a loot box, but you can earn them in game, then technically is it a loot box or is it just free items by playing the game, you know?
So this type of system that we're talking about, these loot boxes, they're also known as gacha in Japan. It comes from gachapon, which I had no idea what that was until I actually looked it up. They're basically, and actually I know them very well they're capsule toys. So they're like the little toys that you would get at, like, let's say you were getting a gumball or something, for example. There were the other toys next to like the fake tattoos that you can get, and they were right. in these little capsules, and like there was a random chance to get some sort of item from it, you know.
Right.
It could be, it's usually some form of plastic BS, but that,
hey, kids love them.
Yeah. And I think that was another thing that they were basing their loot boxes from. So some form of collectible card game to these capsule toy.
And that's just interesting in its own right, because Asia really developed loot boxes almost in a separate way than the Western world.
Mm-hmm.
And the first loot box, I guess, or gacha type of thing was in MapleStory, which this random in-game item came out back in 2004 and cost $1. And it was pretty much the same thing. You buy a ticket, you put the ticket in, and then you would get a random little trinket or something for the game.
So that was the start of our very first loot box back in 2004, and then maybe not based off of this, but 3 years later there was another game, or another developer, back in 2007. They created a MMORPG known as ZT Online, and the Chinese developers made it in a certain way. They made it free to play. Okay. And the reason why they made it free to pay is because they knew...
Free to play.
Free to play, sorry.
MapleStory was also free to play. Yes. But yeah, continue.
They made it free to play because they knew that a lot of Chinese gamers would not be willing to pay full price for a game. And what they would do, and this was actually very popular in Asia, was that you can go to internet cafes or PC cafes where you pay like an hourly fee, for example, to play games. So you're not actually paying for the game. You're just paying for your time.
Right.
And so they made this game free to play with loot boxes. And this was one of the first, I wouldn't say first time successful, because MapleStory was successful. I don't know if the Gachapon game was completely successful, but this is where ZT Online ended up making monthly $15 million US dollars.
Right.
And so this started to begin like a justification that, hey, loot boxes are a way to earn money.
Right. And I think like you were saying, or I guess alluding to, was that MapleStory, it wasn't really, I guess their form of a loot box was sort of just this like playful thing they threw in the game. It wasn't like, oh, we're going to make a ton of money off of this, or this is the future of monetization within games. And I think ZT Online really, that was like a primarily part, that was a big part
that
of
was
the
their
loot
gamble.
Box was like, this is a microtransaction we can put in a game and see if it's successful. And it really was successful.
Yeah. And from here, we started to see that mobile games are jumping on the bandwagon to doing microtransactions. And we actually get, I've played this game. I don't know if you've played this game on mobile. We get Puzzles and Dragons being the first mobile game to earn $1 billion US dollars.
Yeah.
Which is ridiculous. I mean, nowadays it's not as crazy with Pokemon Go. But, I mean, that is a ridiculous sum of money that probably no one ever thought...
was possible with mobile space. Yeah. And honestly, this is like a whole other conversation we could potentially have. But Puzzles and Dragons could have been one of the key games to push the mobile market, including things like Angry Birds and stuff like that. But the mobile market really didn't become this place of spam the entire marketplace with games to try and make as much money as possible until these games started to make a lot of money and prove that mobile was like this really competitive, lucrative place to put your game.
And we see it now, especially in Asia, where Japan is the biggest market for mobile games right now, compared to other countries. And so we see that it's going to stay relevant, mobile games.
Right.
And so
it's also really interesting to just, I guess, point out Puzzles and Dragons as almost returning to the original like gachapon style, or even like collectible card game style, where you're unlocking or purchasing the chance to win characters as opposed to just cosmetic things. If that's correct, right? Like, wouldn't you would get little characters that then you could combine and level up and stuff like that, and that's what you were unlocking?
Yeah, and other games did this. Like, I played Brave Frontier, you played Brave Frontier. It was the same type of style, essentially.
Right, and that is, like, completely different from what a lot of loot boxes have become. And while Asia was really, you know, working on their version of loot boxes, and with, like, Puzzles and Dragons really becoming successful, and then Brave Frontier pretty much copying the exact same thing, the West was still, like, trying to figure out how they would monetize their games. And so you'd have things like Zynga on Facebook, who would have, like, free-to-play little games like, Farmville or something.
Oh, my God.
Farmville. And some of these games had microtransactions that you could do to, like, help speed up progress within the game, because a lot of games in that era were based on time for some reason. Like, oh, wait 2 days and this thing will be built and stuff like that.
I wonder if it had anything to do with, like, maybe not wanting kids. Maybe they had a conscience back then of not wanting kids to play for too long. Or maybe...
Oh, I don't think so, because essentially these games, the whole point was you had to come back. You had to come back and check your farm. You had to come back.
But I guess.
So it was like another... It was a different way of trying to brainwash kids. Mm-hmm. But yes, at this point, loot boxes still hadn't really been implemented, and it wasn't until 2010 that the modern loot box was introduced to the West, and this was with the first version of the Manco loot crate in Valve's Team Fortress 2. This system gave players randomly locked crates as they played the game, so they would just drop into your inventory as you played. But you couldn't actually open the crates unless you purchased a key for $2.50. Then the crates would contain some cosmetic items, not actually for guns or skins or anything like that, but only for your characters. So it was sort of like you got to customize one of the 9 classes when you opened one of these crates. Like, you could put on a new hat, or you could put on... it was only hats to begin with, which was kind of interesting. So ultimately, that's what started, in a way, started this loot box mentality in the West, and what built TF2's economy and popularity. And ultimately, like, if you know anything about TF2, the economy within TF2 is called the hat economy. It's basically all about hats and cosmetics in that way.
Yeah, do you want to go through your personal life of how much you've played TF2 and what you did?
Oh, I have like 1,700 hours in TF2. I've blown hundreds of dollars on TF2. I've made hundreds of dollars off of TF2, and that's something that I'll talk about in a little bit, how you could actually, like, TF2 was the first, at least Western game, where you could make money by opening loot boxes, essentially. Which was like a whole... I mean, there were other ways to make money, but essentially the economy came down to what the pull the entire community had opened in terms of loot boxes and what were inside those loot boxes. But TF2 in general is just this really weird thing. But what I want to get into is I don't want to focus on TF2 too much, but basically focus on what made TF2... this powerhouse of an economy when there weren't loot boxes in the West. And what helped fuel the fire was a feature that was implemented into Steam roughly a year after loot boxes were introduced to TF2. And bear in mind, this is also when TF2 is transitioning into free-to-play as well. So you're having an influx of players, an influx of cosmetic and loot box items, and basically you could also trade... There was a trading feature within Steam, which you gave players the ability to trade items between each other, which then gave the items actual value within the community, because you would see this item is rarer than that item, so I must trade like 12 really crappy hats for a really good hat or something like that. And so that basically instilled a value system within the TF2 economy. But then Valve introduced the Steam Marketplace in 2012, or late 2012, and the Steam Marketplace allowed users to actually buy and sell items. Not only trade, but buy and sell items with Steam Cash. And this was like a whole other thing, and potentially really controversial. is that this instilled that the TF2 economy has a real world value and is now directly linked to a real world currency because it is tied to Steam dollars, which are tied to US dollars.
And since I'm not quite familiar with TF2 and CSGO, and maybe if you're not, to make a small comparison, I know Quinn is going to hit me down on this eventually.
Leave a review or I'm going to beat Chase.
I've actually made a little bit of money selling cards. I'm only $5, but I mean...
Trading cards.
The trading cards. So there's a trading card system that you get from playing games. And I think it's just a chance of like which ones you get in a sense.
Right.
And so I made like... I got one really good card and it sold for $5, which is more than what others were because a lot of them are like 20 cents or something like that or even less.
Right.
And the fact that there is a system for that as well is crazy. And I think it's comparable enough. Would you say?
I think so. This is an additional interesting tidbit about Valve in particular, I guess. And that is, for a lot of things, and we'll talk about this in part 3, I think, with Battle Passes. Valve actually introduced Battle Passes as well. But Valve has really been at the forefront of trying to figure out how to make money off of free things, free software, free games. And so Steam, in with of itself, is a free piece of software that allows you to purchase games and play games. And what they decided was, let's reward people who play games by giving them trading cards related to that game that they play. And then let's give those, allow players to then sell and buy those cards to each other across the Steam marketplace. And what they essentially did was made a trading card game in a way, not necessarily a game, but a trading card. Right, a collectible card ecosystem based around the Steam launcher. So they basically made all these digital assets, which mean nothing, right?
Yeah, they're free. They're even more valueless than like having cosmetics in games where you can actually like be proud of them.
Because
honestly, no one fucking sees the cards. I don't know what cards you have.
So the cards inherently have zero value, but they sell for, like Chase said, up to like $5.
It gets higher than that too. There's been some for $1,000.
Sure. And
that's the ridiculous part.
The point I want to make is that Steam makes 15%. Valve makes 15% of every sale. They made this this worthless digital card ecosystem that they make 15% off of every sale on.
And that's just ridiculous.
That is, so this is, could be a whole episode in its own, is the potentially really manipulative systems Valve makes to make money. And trading cards is way up there because it is literally, you get cards for, I don't even know how it works, because in my head, it's like, how does Valve, at the end of the day, is somehow getting real-world money from people buying and selling trading cards that don't have value.
Exactly.
It's so bizarre.
All right, let's move on to CSGO.
Yeah, getting back, Valve didn't stop with TF2, okay? The year after the Steam Marketplace goes live, Valve brought loot boxes to Counter-Strike Global Offensive. Now, if you don't know what Counter-Strike Global Offensive is, shorthanded CSGO. CSGO at the time was the largest competitive first-person shooter on the market.
And this is the second iteration of Counter-Strike, correct?
No, this is like the fifth.
This is the fifth?
There's Counter-Strike, Counter-Strike 1.6, Counter-Strike Source, Counter-Strike Source something or other.
Oh my god.
They basically, Counter-Strike has been updated since like 99, I believe. Right. It's been out for a long time. That's why it's such a large game and has such a massive following, is that it's like pretty much been the only competitive shooter for a really long time. Or at least the only competitive shooter that's been taken seriously for a really long time up until Overwatch.
Did it make sense to have a marketplace or loot boxes in this then? It was a good... good.
Right. So essentially, Valve did a test of loot boxes in TF2 because TF2 is like the casual FPS of the PC, right, marketplace. And so they did a test. They actually often test things in TF2 and then bring them over to Counter-Strike. And so what they did was they tested in TF2, saw that it actually built an economy of over $50 million in a very short amount of time, which they make 15% off of every trade, by the way, or sale. And they're like, oh, this is a great system to make money. We should put this in Counter-Strike. They put it in Counter-Strike, and you have no idea. This was like the perfect storm for them. Because they had learned so much from TF2 and that marketplace and how loot boxes function within a system like that. They had the Steam marketplace figured out and figured out how to make money off of a system where they already make money. Not only are you spending $2.50 to open a crate, when you wish to sell the item you get, they get another 15% off of that, which is insane. Anyways, the perfect storm happens and the CSGO marketplace for items just booms to a $500 million industry in its own right, which is insane. Which is insane. And you have items like the cosmetic craze in CSGO grew so fast and so big that pretty much there were a large amount of items that you would get from crates that instantly cost thousands of dollars to sell or buy. Thousands of dollars for a skin in a game.
Not even tangible. Oh my god.
Thousands of dollars. It's insane. It's so insane. Because in TF2, right, like the expensive items cost roughly $100 to $200. In CSGO, it's a completely different ball game. It's like times whatever the TF2 equivalent is by 10 to 20. Like, it's so different of an ecosystem, and I don't know how or why it grew that big.
But it gets worse. I think
it just... it gets worse, yeah. So, now CSGO has items that literally cost thousands of dollars, and what I mean specifically by that is that they have a... they're tied to US dollars. They have now digital items you get from loot boxes that are tied to real world money, which hasn't, and in a lot of cases, still isn't the norm for loot boxes and items in general. So this is like, this is a very potentially toxic thing. And what I mean by toxic is that the idea of CSGO items being worth real world money led to third-party websites that would allow players to cash out, which would be where if you have all these CSGO items and your inventory is worth roughly, let's say, $10,000, you would go to this third-party website and say, I want real-world cash, and they would give you maybe... They might give you 15% reduced value of your items, but they would still give you cash. So they might give you maybe $8,000 instead of $10,000, and you'd be like, well, hey, it's digital stuff, whatever, I'm taking $8,000 cash. And then that would be it. You would give all your items to the website and you would get $8,000. Now, this gets even more controversial as gambling sites start to become the norm. And these are third-party websites that would allow players, no matter the age, mind you, the option of gambling on cosmetics and loot boxes and stuff of this sort.
So if I'm to understand correctly, you could be a 13-year-old. You can go on the website.
You could be a 3-year-old, Chase.
Okay, but you don't understand. But 13-year-old right. is, I feel like, the very essence of, you know, people playing this game and then not understanding all the mechanics and the gambling aspect, at least in my opinion. So they would go there. Let's just go. It's just an example. So they would go there. They would put money down in hopes to get a good item that these people already hold. Does that sound correct? Is that how it works?
So there's actually, I don't know what the official version is today, because there has been some sort of legislation passed and some of these companies have been gone after. But back in the day, there were different types of gambling websites. So you could basically enter a pool where other players are betting, and you would all bet on who is going to win or who's going to, essentially who's going to win. And then the website would take a fraction of the entire pool, and then the website would basically roll dice and tell you who wins everybody else's items, minus some, because the website has to make money. So you would submit all your items or a number of your items to this website.
And they would have some monetary value, and they would take a percentage of that monetary value. And
then right. So they would calculate in real time, show you the value of all the items within the pool, tell you the pool's rough value size, like in a dollar amount. Like if 10 people are playing at this particular gambling website, the pool would be $1,000 worth of items. The winner would get $800 worth of items, and then the website would take $200.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it would just be a random chance, and it would just scroll through the names of the people within the pool and then give the winner all those items. Now, there were also other websites where you would be basically only playing against the house, and the house would have virtual loot boxes that are on their website that they would say, like, here, give us money and we'll up your chances. Like, if you give us more money, we'll give you better chances at unlocking better stuff. Like, essentially, CSGO had crates, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or weapon crates. And you would have a specific percentage to getting certain items within that crate. The website would say, if you give us more money, we can up those percentages because we already have all of those items in our inventory. So we'll just basically recycle or repurpose a loot box, right? Because the website has a ton of inventory in stock, mm-hmm. they can pretty much simulate a secondary third-party loot box. And so you'd have these third-party loot box gambling websites.
And I'm assuming that this is the start of the big issue with CSGO and the people who owned a gambling website, right? And then they...
Right.
Which we'll discuss in part two, but do you want to give like a little flavor of it?
This leads into things where, because things are happening on third parties and Valve has no control over it, third parties start manipulating percentages and manipulating odds to the point where not only are they ripping people off, whoever goes on to third parties, but they'll be manipulating people on like YouTube to go to these third party websites and then get ripped off.
So if you listen to Monday's episode, you'll also notice that in the United States that they can't give percentages to like the chances of...
They don't have to. Yeah.
They don't have to. And that probably also plays a factor into this as well, is that they can give the percentages, but it doesn't have to mean anything. Essentially,
well, also, no right, but also because it's not a game, because these mm-hmm. are third party websites, that like even gets grayer and fuzzier.
Yeah,
it's because they're not directly related to CSGO, so it's like this weird, even if Valve gives percentages on loot boxes, it doesn't mean the third party has to. So it's like, we'll talk about it more in part two and how that all breaks down and what. Because several different countries take this very seriously, and precautions, and Valve has to step up in a lot of ways. Yeah. But
with CSGO success, some other games started implementing similar loot boxes like CSGO, such as Battlefield 4 and Call of Duty Advanced Warfare. I think you mentioned earlier that it's like loadout crates. Is that what you would call them?
No, they have different names for them, but essentially it was the same thing. Like, you could get skins and stuff for it was cosmetic stuff. And Battlefield 4 actually didn't even allow you to purchase these crates until roughly a year after they were introduced. So that was more of just random items given to players, but in the form of a crate or a loot box.
Oh, before but Call of Duty.
Right. So you couldn't even purchase it. It was just you were given loot boxes that would give you random items as a player. Mm-hmm. And then a year later, you could purchase it, which then made it, I guess, officially a loot box. And then Call of Duty Advanced Warfare, You could buy loot boxes, which would give you skins and other cosmetics and stuff like that.
And there were other game genres as well that were experimenting with loot boxes. Like some of the MMOs like Star Trek Online, Lord of the Rings Online also had loot boxes of some form. I never actually played either of those games, so I don't have that much information on it. But I know, I'm almost positive Lord of the Rings is shut down. So not because of loot boxes, but for a lack of play.
I think it was revived, but that is beside the point. Yeah. So other genres are really trying to things out. Mass Effect 3 actually had
this one's surprising as well.
Yeah, Mass Effect 3, which was a single player game, mind you, offered loot boxes, which had like uncommon armor and stuff like that. But from what I've read, the reason why there isn't a whole lot of controversy behind Mass Effect 3 was because they took really special care to make sure that it wasn't necessary to buy loot boxes. Like, you could, I'm pretty sure, but it was easier to obtain them as a player, and you could get armors and stuff easy as a player, so it wasn't this forced mechanic, I guess.
And I think you may have missed this part. This was the first packaged game to offer loot boxes.
What do you mean by packaged?
A game that you can physically buy.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah. That's a little surprising.
Yeah.
You would think like, oh, these other games had it, but no, they kind of started it. Okay. So there have been other games as well that had similar things, like the trading card game. You had FIFA. So if you ever played FIFA, there is a special game mode known as FIFA Ultimate, where essentially you play online against other players. Well, you don't have to play completely online, but the point of it is that you would buy card packs. And then by buying these card packs, you can change your roster. So, you know, you can have Messi and Cristiano Ronaldo on the same team, right? But like the two best players in the world. And so how that would work is like you would either buy it through like an eBay-like system, you know, so Messi would be like 3 million FIFA points. Or you can try and win him essentially like by buying card packs. And so the card packs range from 7,500 FIFA coins all the way up to 125K per pack. And so if you wanted to be relevant, you would have to buy the 125K pack. And just to give you an idea of like how much that cost approximately, it's about 4,300 FIFA coins per dollar.
Hmm.
So it's about $30 for a 125K pack. A little bit less than that. But if you wanted to be relevant, you would have to buy the large packs because those ones had the high, epic or legendary tier people. And they guaranteed you, like, for the most part, maybe not Messi, but a high-level player. But they did not guarantee you to get the best player, for example, the ones that cost the most, because they also even came out later. This is interesting in itself. Like, you can get like the 96th percentile Messi, but then later they'll come out with the 99th percentile Messi.
Oh wow.
Yeah, so I mean, and I don't know like how exactly it works. I think it's like dependent on the year, like what people considered what was the best year for Messi or something like that. Or
right. So player. You'll have like the 1999 Pele or something like that.
Yeah, I wonder if Pele even played. That's future Pele, Quinn.
1999, yeah, old Pele.
Pele when he's 50, yeah, okay.
Yeah, that'd be interesting, actually. Just have like an old FIFA team.
Yeah, so that would be pretty funny. So then you also had games like League of Legends, which came out in 2015, 2016. And this one was really hard for us to understand, honestly, because they have a very complicated loot box system. Right. But in the essential idea is that you could buy crates and they give you chances to earn fragments, which you need to collect together in order to essentially buy cosmetics.
Right. And one thing to clarify is that League of Legends didn't come out in 2015, 2006. This is when they introduced loot boxes into the game. But like Chase was saying, so these crates were roughly $1, and skins in League of Legends are often like $15. So they obviously didn't want to give you $15 skins from buying a $1 crate. So what they would do is they would give you a third of a skin. And so you would need to open other crates and try and sort of do a matching game. You'd have to get another third of the exact same skin and then another third of the exact same skin in order to unlock that full skin.
So if you're extremely lucky, you get it by paying exactly $3.
Right. If you're extremely lucky, you can pay $3 and get a $15 skin, but they have over 100 champions in the game, so the likelihood of you getting the exact same skin three times in a row is so unheard of, I would think.
And one of the interesting things about League of Legends that we were looking into was like, how much would it cost to actually earn all the... the skins.
All the skins, the cosmetics, yeah.
And so, like, if you don't include the ones that are only obtainable through the crates, it was like $7,000 or something like that to obtain
right.
them
if
all.
You straight up bought all the skins in the game, if you bought everything in the game, it would be $7,000 to $8,000.
But if you include the ones that are only obtainable by crates, then it skyrocketed up to $17,000.
Right. If you wanted to try and get everything from crates, it was over twice as much to get the stuff.
Yeah. And just to forewarn you, we don't mean that it's guaranteed with $17,000. It's just that you, probably whoever did the calculation like said, you have a 99% chance. That's enough to say that, yeah, you probably got it.
Right. And I think the hypothetical also was that like that's not including getting duplicates from stuff.
Yeah. And that helps you, I think, getting when
you get
duplicates.
Yeah, it helps you a lot. So... yeah. If you got duplicates, you would be screwed. You could be infinitely trapped there forever.
Right.
Around the same time, and potentially a little bit earlier because Overwatch was in beta for a whole year pretty much, Overwatch came out with loot boxes. I mean, it was included with the base game. And with loot boxes, what would happen is that, similar to League of Legends, every time you level up, you would get a crate. And if you won 3 games in the arcade playlist, you would also get a crate, up to 3 a week. So that gave you multiple options on getting crates. And so you didn't really have to, in a way, purchase them because you were getting up to maybe 10 crates a day. Or not a day, sorry, 10 crates a week. Or if you played competitive and stuff like that and you leveled up a lot and you played the game, you were getting a fair amount of content for free. But if you wanted to buy crates, they were roughly $1 each. And I think what goes in Overwatch's favor is that there is no economy, there's no trading, there's no nothing. So the skins and cosmetics really don't have real world value. So it's completely up to the player to play the loot box game. Another thing is that you can actually buy the skin or pose or voice line or play the game intro you want specifically with in-game currency. So you don't have to go through all of these hoops and stuff to try and earn your way there, or I guess not earn, to luck your way there with loot boxes. Ultimately, if you've played enough or you've earned enough loot boxes, you will have in-game currency that's been recycled from getting duplicates or from getting money, currency drops. So you'll have some money to actually spend on the things that you want. So you're not forced to use loot boxes as your only way of obtaining items.
So far, at least what I understand is Overwatch's loot box system has been the least controversial as compared to
the other ones. I think it is, if in terms of loot boxes, and we'll talk about in part 3 that there may be alternatives to loot boxes, but in terms of loot boxes, it is pretty consumer friendly in a lot of ways.
But then we had Shadow of War come out, and this was essentially a single-player campaign as well. I'm trying to think if there were any multiplayer aspects.
No significant multiplayer aspect to the game. But before Chase gets in this, I want to mention this is when things start to break down.
This is when we're starting to get into laws and legislations that are about to happen, or like investigations are starting to occur.
and even just general outlook from a player perspective, that loot boxes are starting to become anti-consumer pretty quick.
All right. So here's one of the reasons. And so Shadow of War, when it came out, it came in with loot boxes. And so basically, you can get these things called war chests. There's some other types of chests as well. But what it allowed you to get was orc followers. So that's a very important mechanic in the game Shadow of War. Because like pretty much most of the game is you... Not Shadow of War, but at least Shadow of Mordor for sure. And it probably continued in this way. Is that you needed orc followers in order to strengthen your army, in order to beat the game, essentially. And one of the parts in Shadow of War, there is a point, I think it's in part 4 because it's a 4-part game. You need to have a large orc following to do like a defense against these other enemy orcs attacking you. And this actually got a lot of debate when it came out, because a lot of people felt that the game really slows down and it makes it very time consuming to want to go through the game. Like, I think if you played it normally, you can probably get through the first few parts in about 8 or 10 hours. And then a lot of people felt like it doubled when you got to part 4, or the last part where you had to do the defense portion of the game. And it didn't feel like it had that much story value when it was done.
Right. So a lot of people were drawing the conclusion that, well, first off, why
were the chests bad?
In 2017 are there loot boxes in a single player game, and why are the loot boxes put in a displayed in a manner that makes me think I have to make microtransactions to move through the game in a reasonable amount of time.
And these war chests, they had things that essentially made it faster. They had things
right.
Like,
so they would give you
boosts and stuff like that.
The main thing was that gold chests, which were like $2.50 each or something around that amount, would give you a legendary follower, as well as some higher ranked followers as well. So you would be walking away from paying $2.50, pretty much saving yourself almost an hour's worth of time or more, because legendary followers are pretty difficult to get and time consuming. Ultimately, the gameplay is fun enough where you can convince yourself that, like, hey, it's fun to go get a legendary follower. It's a lot of planning and skill. But a lot of people didn't like the fact that you needed to do this over and over and over and over again to get a large enough army to actually end the game. Yeah.
So,
and that only gets worse.
Yeah, with Battlefront 2. So
as a couple months pass, Battlefront 2... Well, actually, I guess the beta starts before.
I'm trying to decide what to do. Let's just talk about a little bit of its like setup, and then I'll go into like how this timeline happened. Like,
right,
what happened, which will include Destiny 2, NBA 2K18, and Battlefront 2. So this game essentially introduced loot boxes, and these type of loot boxes had you get things like star chips, weapons, boosts, other accessories. And one of the things that made it controversial was the fact that if you wanted to make yourself stronger than others in the multiplayer game or the online aspect, is if you purchase enough boxes, you could actually theoretically be stronger than the other person.
Yeah, so essentially what this meant was that star chips were needed to level up your character in various ways. And the only way to get a significant amount of star chips was to open loot boxes, which, by the way, you could purchase with actual money.
And one of the reasons why it was also more controversial was the fact that it didn't actually guarantee you certain items. It just gave you more chances of obtaining these items.
Right. There was no way to directly purchase star chips, or there was no way to directly purchase something you wanted. You could only purchase the chance to get the thing you wanted, or the chance to make your character stronger.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of You want to do the punchline?
Yeah, so we decided to dub this as Pay for a Chance to Win or P2C2W.
So instead of Pay to Win or P2W, it's P2C2W. Yeah. Pay for the chance to win instead of pay to win.
So let's go into the timeline. So the game, I told you, came out November 2017. So we're going to start off in June 10th, kind of like the culmination all the way up to the point when Battlefront 2 came out. So even before June 10th, there were issues with Battlefront. Okay, I actually played Battlefront. I thought I played Battlefront 2, but I guess not for the longest time. And so when Battlefront came out, it didn't have a single player campaign, and it didn't feel like it had a lot of content in it in itself as well. And so a lot of people were kind of miffed by that, by the game. And so EA, I'm assuming, was like, hey, we need to do better on this, or at least Lucasfilms, whoever collaborated with EA. And so they wanted to come out with Battlefront 2. And on June 10th, they previewed it, and they were committed to make the game that fans wanted. Okay, so that's the start. People were a little cautious, but they were hoping. August 4th, this is when Shadow of War introduces their loot boxes, and fans were not pleased by it. By what we talked about earlier, it was very terrible gaming, essentially in the last part.
It was bad practice.
Yeah, and then it got worse. When in September, when games like NBA 2K18, which had a lot of microtransactions, which I'm not familiar with that game exactly what the microtransactions are. The whole point was that the fans were not happy about it.
Right. And this leads into Destiny 2 as well, where Bright Engrams, which was essentially a loot box mechanic, was also introduced. And I think the thing with both these games was neither of these games needed these types of microtransactions. And they didn't in the past. So players were kind of getting pissed off at the fact that in 2017, all of these games are coming out with more and more microtransactions and loot boxes when they don't necessarily need them.
Yes. And again, to reiterate what Quinn said, Destiny didn't have loot boxes in any way, shape, or form.
Until 2015, after several updates, they had microtransactions. But originally on launch, they did not have microtransactions
at
all.
So you're kind of getting the idea that games are really transitioning over to loot box heavy things for everything.
Right. They're figuring out, oh, we can make a lot more money if we put a lot of microtransactions or loot boxes into our games.
So October 10th, the beta comes out for Battlefront 2, and the fans that were in the beta get a little suspicious because they're like, oh, the star cards are back from the previous Battlefront. And they remember that this was like an issue in the last game. And, you know, EA probably was like, oh, don't worry about it. But the point of it was one of the reporters, I think her name was like Heather. I can't remember if she was for Kotaku or someone else, but she said that theoretically you can buy your way to victory. So if you pay enough money, you're going to be the best in the multiplayer aspect of the game.
Or at least your character will be the best.
Yeah, maybe not you. You could probably
Maybe you suck and you won't win. But
you'll be better than the sucky people.
Right. You'll have better equipment. You'll have a better character.
So November 12th comes around, so a few more days before the game is released, they're starting to get the currency in the game is credits, and they're starting to get ideas of how much certain characters that you want to unlock cost, and one of them being like Skywalker, Luke Skywalker, who was 60,000 credits, and I think it was Reddit users who did this, but they calculated how long it would take to grind out for free, essentially, Luke Skywalker. And they said it would take 2 days full of grinding, or essentially 48 hours of playing the game.
Yeah, 48 hours straight of grinding for one character. And it for the next, I guess, several days, the conversation stays on Reddit and really becomes the, I guess, the battlefront for Battlefront 2.
Would you, Quinn, would you do the honors and read the most downrated quote in history
for Reddit? Right. So what happened, and I was actually, I was there on this historic day.
You downrated?
In the Reddit thread. I did downvote. Oh, you, wow. So what happened was EA was doing an Ask Me Anything or having an open conversation about Battlefront 2 because, like Chase was mentioning, this is 2 days before the game is supposed to launch, or several days before the game is supposed to launch. And there is a lot of controversy brewing and players are getting really pissed off, especially when they're doing the math and saying that this game is just a grind or I have to spend a lot of money. So EA essentially says that their argument for having this system for grinding characters for 2 days or spending money on loot boxes, the intent, and I quote, the intent is to provide players with a sense of pride and accomplishment for unlocking different heroes. We selected initial values based upon data from the open beta and other adjustments made to milestone rewards before launch. Among other things, we're looking at average per player credit earn rates on a daily basis, and we'll be making constant adjustments to ensure that players have challenges that are compelling, rewarding, and of course, attainable via gameplay. End quote. Now I want to focus specifically on the first sentence, which is probably what EA is known for now as a meme. Everyone hates EA. They really didn't like EA before this, but this has like solidified in a lot of gamers' minds that EA is a terrible company. And that was their idea for making, like, the reasoning behind making the game a grind is to provide players with a sense of pride and accomplishment. And this has been memed 1,001 times over, but essentially what players felt was that EA, or the person responding for EA, was saying, we think you'll take pride and be accomplished by spending money on loot boxes, and you'll feel really rewarded that you finally got Luke Skywalker by spending $50 and getting random amounts of in-game currency. And people were pissed. Like Chase said, most downvoted quote on Reddit. And I think it was at 100-something thousand downvotes, which was insane.
A game shouldn't be lengthened due to crates or like needing to earn stuff in that way. Games should be played for a long time because they're fun.
Right. And so, also on top of that, it's not even, this isn't even like the single player aspect, right? Like this is multiplayer where you know people are going to spend money to beat one another, especially when there's an option to pay to win. Like, or I guess a pay to for the chance to win. P2C2W. Like, come on.
So, as this debacle occurs, November 13th comes around, and then EA was like, maybe it's a little too expensive for Luke Skywalker. And so they actually reduced the cost from 60K to 15K, which is a big difference, actually.
Well, I want to say, too, is that how could they argue that 60K was a good amount based on data from the open beta? How could they ever think that 60K, four times what they reduced it to? How would it... What?
I don't know, Quinn.
They're like, oh, 48 hours of game time is a good amount of time to get Skywalker. And then they're like, oh, crap, people are pissed. We got to reduce it to 12 hours.
I guess, like, if there's a way to argue for them, which is never, this isn't a good thing. But, you know, people over there can probably put time into the games far more than the average Joe person. And so they probably did not account at all for the fact that people have fucking lives and can't put right. that time in. Or if they did, then they intentionally knew that or they knew that and they sabotaged it anyway, which is probably the
truth. Well, I think there is a point to that, and that is that these people aren't the smartest people. And when you have an open beta that only lasts for a certain period of time, people are going to cram as much time as they possibly can into that, especially if they're excited for your game. So that window of time, whether it's 2 days or a week, isn't going to accurately represent the amount of time people are going to play when the game is officially released.
Yeah, and to iterate something, this game isn't bad. The game was actually
fun. Terrible.
No. The game I've heard was actually fun.
Yeah, I played the beta and it was a good time. It was pretty much like Battlefield Star Wars Battlefield.
Yeah. You know? So the game is not that bad. It just becomes nearly unplayable when you introduce the loot boxes.
And this was the turning point for a lot of people, especially because in the gaming community, there were like the hardcore people that were saying that loot boxes were bad and consumer-friendly practices weren't really at the forefront of gaming at this place in time. And the vast majority of gamers, I guess console gamers in particular, because a lot of the loot box and microtransactions were happening on PC and online or on browser-based games and stuff like that, or mobile. So if you played on console, you didn't really see all this happening until Battlefront 2 and until Shadow of Mordor, where you're like, what is going on? How did we get to this point? Why are people trying to rip all the money out of my pockets? Mm-hmm. And I think that's what really stirred the pot, was it got mainstream gamers on board with the idea that loot boxes in this form are very malicious and anti-consumer.
Yes, and it will continue to get worse because November 15th comes around, and I don't want to say the first time that it occurred, because there are other countries who are against loot boxes in the first place because they just deemed it as gambling.
Right. Actually, this happens in roughly, I think, like 2015, where CSGO is being investigated.
Mm-hmm.
And so by 2 years down the road with Battlefront, governments are aware and like keen to watch what is happening.
Probably because it's a console game. That's probably one big reason why as well.
Well, and it's EA, you know, and if it's the most downvoted thing on Reddit.
And like, EA is the most hated company in the world. At
right. So like there's a lot of things against EA at this point, and really governments are paying attention, or at least some people in governments are paying attention.
And so BF2 gets investigated by the Belgian government for their loot boxes because of its availability to minors, and this connection that we'll later talk about in our second episode, that it's related to gambling.
Right.
And so November 17th comes. That's the launch of the game, I believe.
Yep.
Right before it, they removed these transactions.
So right, they make it impossible for you to spend money within the game.
Yeah,
which is a whole lot, because
it takes a lot for EA if you make EA do this.
Right, and to your point, like playing devil's advocate, they technically released a game that has no microtransactions, right? Like although it took a lot for them to like figure out that they were really scummy, in some sense they did release a game that was better because of consumers, like because of all of these conversations with consumers, and because of the beta, they technically released a fairer game, I guess.
They did come out later, I think it was in March or so, where they introduced a more wholesome system, quote unquote.
Right.
They had a
right.
progression system.
Right.
For getting your abilities and whatnot. So they did listen to their fans, or the people who love Star Wars, or the people who hate loot boxes. I don't know who they were listening to, but
the journey doesn't end here, Chase. The journey doesn't end.
No.
EA has a lot more in store for them in the future, and there's going to be plenty more stupid quotes on the way in part 2 of the loot box saga.
Oh my god, yeah, it gets, there's some interesting shit that's going to go through there, and I'm very excited for that when we get to it. All right, well, thank you for listening, guys. This was a lot. I hope you guys took in all the pain and suffering that there has been in loot boxes, and maybe some of the good stuff. There's some good stuff coming out of loot boxes. Like we talked about before, it was a way for companies who could only sell video games at $60 because no one was willing to pay more for it, for them to make more money. And there have been games who have done it right. I would say we could argue a little bit with Overwatch because they always come out with constant updates, right?
Right.
They take the money that they get from these transactions and then they put it back into the game to make it better.
And they give you free content, which is always good. And I think, yeah, even with going back to Valve, I mean, TF2 is free to play. CSGO is now free to play. Dota 2 is free to play. All their games are free to play. And they're running off of this same model of in-game microtransactions and loot boxes and cosmetics. So ultimately, someone's got to pay the bills. Right. And
it's the 1% of people who actually pay too much for these games.
They're actually called whales. There is a name for them, and that is the people that are willing to spend thousands of dollars within a game because they are so obsessed with it.
And that's why you get to play for free.
right. And that's why they can still, you get to play for free. All those millions of players get to play for free. And they can still put millions of dollars into their esports because people just buy cosmetics and really like loot boxes.
Because of the whales.
Well, the whales help a lot too. Yeah.
Well, Quinn, where can they get a hold of us if they want to give us their opinions on loot boxes?
Yeah, if you guys have any more examples of loot boxes in games that you do not like or you do like, please tweet us at BS Gamers Podcast on Twitter. Our ears are open, our eyes are wide, and we're ready to read and hear what you have to say, so say it, and we might have a conversation. Me and Chase did a lot of research, and we have a lot of things that we could talk about and would love to talk about, and we'll be talking about in part 2 and 3 of this series. Hello?
I don't know what else to say to that. That was a great ending to it. All right, guys, I'm Chase.
Well, what could they do, Chase, to even if they want to go beyond tweeting us, what can they do? How about that?
You know, beyond tweeting us, guys, there's another way that's even better. It's probably arguably the most important thing that you can do, and that is to rate us and review us on Apple Podcasts or whatever you're listening to. Whatever platform, we would greatly appreciate it. It means a lot because we're like a super small podcast. We're working our way up there. We want to get to the top.
We're putting a lot of time and effort into this. You know, we've been working on this Google Doc for pretty much all week, and I think it's really turning out. And you know, it's nice to get a little feedback, a little review here and there. And it helps me from taking my anger and frustration out on Chase. So just be aware of that.
Yeah, we'd love to hear from you guys. It would be fun. This is why we do it. It's more for the fun of it. We do enjoy doing this podcast aspect because we enjoy talking about video games. And we thought, what better way to do it than be at least informative and then giving it out to the community.
Right. Learning ourselves, teaching people about what's going on helps us, helps you. We love you. Chase loves you. We'll see you in the next two. See you in the next two parts.
See you guys soon.